Mark Stein's Sunday Poems.
Here's some rhymes for the times as we go from bad to verse. You may have seen me on the telly the other day talking about the latest wacky utterance from Joe Biden. They let him out of the White House basement and it's all going fine. And then he wanders off prompter and says something hinting at a rich fantasy life that seems far more engrossing to him than reading out some other guy's words about the economy. This faintly surreal moment from the campaign trail was one of my favourites.
Because if you could take care, if you were a quartermaster, you can sure in hell take care of running a, you know, department store thing, you know, where in the second floor of the ladies' department or whatever, you know what I mean?
You can see why he's been so happy in his basement these last 6 months. He makes no sense to the outside world, but in his honeycombed mind there is some rich interior existence in which Joe rappels down into the ravine to rescue Esther Williams from Corn Pop and Victor Mature's lion dog-faced pony soldier. Which put me in mind of this marvellous poem from the 16th century, "My mind to me a kingdom is." Joe Biden's mind may seem a wasteland to outside observers, but inside all kinds of startling occurrences are breaking out all over the vast, unbounded kingdom stretching beyond the far horizon. You know the thing. For many years, this piece was thought to be by the courtier poet Sir Edward Dyer. And then late in the 20th century, scholars began arguing that, in fact, it was by the 17th Earl of Oxford. If you have a hard time keeping your Earls of Oxford straight, the 17th is the one who is sometimes said to have written Shakespeare's plays. He is also the subject of one of the most memorable passages in John Aubrey's lovely book, Brief Lives, which delighted me as a schoolboy. And the book itself is one of those works I like if I'm laid up in bed and just want something to dip in and out of for 20 minutes in between taking the medicine and its effects kicking in. And while one is dipping in and out, one comes across this arresting vignette in which Lord Oxford is brought into the presence of Queen Elizabeth I and bows low, so low, in fact, that he breaks wind. This is why, if you are ever ushered into the presence of the sovereign, one should bow only from the neck, less chance of any embarrassment. I mention this only because Joe Biden seems likely to be entering this phase well before the next G7. Anyway, the Earl of Oxford was so mortified by his flatulence before the Queen and the court that he immediately left England and went travelling abroad for the next 7 years, at which point he thought he'd put sufficient time and distance between him and the flatulence that he could now go back. Quote from John Aubrey. "On his return, the Queen welcomed him home and said, 'My Lord, I had forgot the fart.'" First published in 1588 in William Byrd's Psalms, Sonnets and Songs by Sir Edward Dyer, or possibly the Earl of Oxford, "My mind to me a kingdom is." "My mind to me a kingdom is, such perfect joy therein I find that it excels all other bliss that world affords or grows by kind. Though much I want, which most men have, yet still my mind forbids to crave. No princely pomp, no wealthy store, no force to win the victory, no wily wit to salve a sore, no shape to feed each gazing eye. To none of these I yield as thrall, for why my mind doth serve for all. I see how plenty suffers oft, how hasty climbers soon do fall. I see that those that are aloft, mishap doth threaten most of all. They get with toil, they keep with fear. Such cares my mind could never bear. Content I live, this is my stay. I seek no more than may suffice. I press to bear no haughty sway. Look what I lack, my mind supplies." Lo, thus I triumph like a king, content with that my mind doth bring. Some have too much, yet still do crave. I little have, and seek no more. They are but poor, though much they have, and I am rich with little store. They poor, I rich. They beg, I give. They lack, I leave. They pine, I live. I laugh not at another's loss. I grudge not at another's gain. No worldly waves my mind can toss. My state at one doth still remain. I fear no foe, nor fawning friend. I loathe not life, nor dread my end. Some weigh their pleasure by their lust, their wisdom by their rage of will. Their treasure is their only trust, and cloaked craft their store of skill. But all the pleasure that I find is to maintain a quiet mind. My wealth is health and perfect ease, my conscience clear, my chief defence. I neither seek by bribes to please, nor by deceit to breed offence. Thus do I live, thus will I die. Would all did so, as well as I. A poem from me to you, either by Sir Edward Dyer or by the Earl of Oxford. And a good way to maintain a calm equilibrium when your minders shut you up in the basement like one of the loopier Ottoman sultans. My mind to me a kingdom is, such a perfect joy therein I find. Corn pop, pony soldiers, quartermasters in the second floor ladies' department, across the bars of Joe Biden's basement window, the kingdom stretches to the far horizon. The 17th Earl of Oxford was, like his father, a great musical patron. He was friends with William Byrd, possibly the greatest composer of the English Renaissance, and Byrd wrote this piece for him around, I would guess, the late 1580s, the Earl of Oxford's March. The Canadian Brass with the Earl of Oxford's March by William Byrd. Here's a poem by Shelley, a couplet of which popped into my head as I was watching a TV news story about a couple of gym owners in New Jersey in a legal battle with the state over reopening their business. The state just cleaned out their bank account electronically, which is a bit of a problem, as that leaves them unable to afford legal representation for their battle with the state. And this is the couplet that swam up from some half-remembered schoolroom lesson. Those ungrateful drones who would drain your sweat, nay, drink your blood. The great divide in many Western jurisdictions now, California is a very good example, is between those who, in H.G. Wells's phrase from The Time Machine, keep things going, the unglamorous types doing unglamorous work, and the political class and the media and the celebrities and big tech and the permanent bureaucracy ranged against them. And it seems to me somewhere along the way in this grim year, perhaps during the 8 months it took the United States Congress to negotiate a $600 handout for people forbidden by the state to go to work, that we have crossed a line and that our rulers have moved from draining our sweat, in other words, living off the fruits of our labours, to drinking our blood. In California, the middle class, the people who keep things going, are fleeing. The problem is, there's fewer and fewer places to flee to. But when you look at that lousy 5,593-page COVID relief bill, the one with 1.5 pages of COVID relief and 5,591 pages of giveaways to those who are better connected, it's hard to see why the people who keep things going would want to keep things going. For people who give the impression ever more openly of being entirely happy to drink your blood. Shelley was a great lyric poet who was also a political radical, and he wrote this poem in, by comparison with the rest of his work, in a very unpoetical way. It's very direct, very simple. It's mostly a series of questions that are variations of the same question to his audience. Why keep things going? Obviously, his circumstances 2 centuries ago are not ours. The rich robes he refers to are these days made in China, and Western citizens work mainly in service jobs, washing macchiatos, or in attendant paperwork industries such as accounting. But the central question remains, sharpened by a year of total state power and the ruination of millions of small businesses built up over decades, by Percy Bysshe Shelley, A Song to the Men of England. Men of England, wherefore plough for the lords who lay ye low? Wherefore weave with toil and care the rich robes your tyrants wear? Wherefore feed and clothe and save from the cradle to the grave those ungrateful drones who would drain your sweat, nay, drink your blood? Wherefore, bees of England, forge many a weapon, chain and scourge, that these stingless drones may spoil the forced produce of your toil? Have ye leisure, comfort, calm, shelter, food, love's gentle balm? Or what is it ye buy so dear with your pain and with your fear? The seed ye sow, another reaps. The wealth ye find, another keeps. The robes ye weave, another wears. The arms ye forge, another bears. Sow seed, but let no tyrant reap. Find wealth, let no impostor heap. Weave robes, let not the idle wear. Forge arms in your defence to bear. Shrink to your cellars, holes and cells. In hall ye deck another dwells. Why shake the chains ye wrought? Ye see the steel ye tempered. Glance on ye. With plough and spade and hoe and loom, trace your grave and build your tomb, and weave your winding sheet till fair England be your sepulchre. A poem from me to you by Percy Bysshe Shelley, a song to the men of England. You can find it in the collected poetical works his widow Mary Shelley published in 1839, 17 years after her young husband's death in a boating accident. Mrs. Shelley, of course, was the author of Frankenstein. And for something of the backstory of Frankenstein, check out my introduction to one of our Halloween tales for our time, The Vampire. And as I mentioned that H.G. Wells line about how things are kept going, I should also remind you that another of our tales for our time is that great Wells classic of the Eloy and the Morlocks, The Time Machine. You can find them all at our Tales for Our Time homepage. After Shelley trying to rouse the masses with his words, let's try it with music. And in fact, from the only opera ever to start a revolution, La Muette de Portici, The Mute Girl of Portici, on August the 25th, 1830, the performance at the Théâtre de la Monnaie in Brussels broke down after the aria Amour Sacré de la Patrie, Sacred Love of the Fatherland, which quotes directly from the Marseillaise. And half the crowd left and took to rioting, and thus began the Belgian Revolution, and 4 months later, the southern provinces of the Netherlands were the independent kingdom of Belgium. Here, from that revolution-rousing opera, La Muette de Portici, is Daniel Auber's overture. Don't get too worked up. The overture to La Muette de Portici by Daniel François Esprit Aubert, played by the Radio Bratislava Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrzej Lenard. I suppose we should be relieved that on last year's 75th anniversary of VJ Day, our leaders did not actually apologize for winning the war against the Japanese Empire. But there were, nevertheless, some shameful moments in the commemoration. Three quarters of a century ago, British Commonwealth troops marched through Asia bellowing Kipling's Road to Mandalay. And in their honor, it was supposed to be sung at the climax of the anniversary gala by the great bass baritone Willard White. Sir Willard is one of the Queen's Jamaican subjects. He has a beautiful voice and an utterly empty head. So he put his foot down and said he wouldn't sing Road to Mandalay because it represented, quote, cultural superiority. One might note that you need a certain amount of cultural superiority to win a war, which is one reason why the unending but unwon wars of this century have gone so badly. But we needn't reach that, as the judges say, in the case of Willard White, who said he, quote, felt uneasy singing lines about one god being superior to another, which is actually the essence of religion, if you think about it. Much needed discussions are taking place challenging assumptions of cultural superiority, continued Sir Willard, and the inequalities caused by them. As a proud human being, I couldn't sing such sentiments with a clear conscience. And after raising this with the BBC production team, it was mutually agreed that another work should be selected. Yeah, it was all very mutual, I'm sure. The line that made him uneasy about one god being superior to another was this: "And I see the first a smoking of a whacking white cheroot, and a wasting Christian kisses on an heathen idol's foot." By which he means the Burmese girl he's taken with is kissing a statue of Buddha, the heathen idol, which Buddha is to a Christian, as Christ would be vice versa. Now, it should hardly be necessary to say this to Sir Willard, who is by profession an actor. He's a singing actor in opera, where the acting can get a bit iffy, but nevertheless, that is what he does. He plays characters in dramatic narratives for a living. And Kipling's poem is written from the point of view of an English Tommy recalling his days in Burma. That's the character. That's the point of view on the situation. And just to make Willard White even more of a bona fide moron of the week, the poem is objectively pro-Burma. The soldier is now back in England and he's walking out with housemaids and it's not the same. And he misses Burma because if you've heard the Easter calling, you won't never eat naught else. And with that line, Kipling captures something that generations of Englishmen felt and feel. The Caribbean and Africa and the Pacific were colonies, but India and Ceylon and Singapore were love affairs, and Burma most of all. Kipling was 24 when he wrote this poem, and as smitten as any old soldier. Here's what he wrote on another occasion. "When I die, I will be a Burman, with 20 yards of real king silk that has been made in Mandalay about my body, and a succession of cigarettes between my lips, and I will always walk about with a pretty almond-coloured girl who shall laugh and jest too as a young maiden ought. She shall not pull a sari over her head when a man looks at her and glares suggestively from behind it, nor shall she tramp behind me when I walk, for these are the customs of India. She shall look all the world between the eyes in honesty and good fellowship, and I will teach her not to defile her pretty mouth with chopped tobacco in a cabbage leaf, but to inhale good cigarettes of Egypt's best brand." Unquote. So she's going to be a little English and smoking store-bought fags, and he's going to be very Burman, with 20 yards of silk wrapped around him. That doesn't sound like cultural superiority to me, but a little give and take, and more give from his side than from hers. Young Rudyard wasn't the only one with an eye for those pretty almond-coloured girls. Until well into the 70s, 80s, framed prints of the Burmese girl were as ubiquitous in the living rooms of English suburban cul-de-sacs as posters of the tennis player scratching her bum were on the walls of the sad bedsits of horny young men. Willard White's act of cultural vandalism is not a small thing. Were it to hold, the damage would outweigh all the contributions of Sir Willard on stages across the world. So in the face of such Philistine idiocy, it is necessary to take a stand on the road to Mandalay and make the old Mule Mine pagoda the hill to die on. First published in the Scots Observer of June the 21st, 1890, by Rudyard Kipling, Mandalay. By the old Mule Mine pagoda, looking lazy at the sea, there's a Burma girl a-settin', and I know she thinks of me. For the wind is in the palm trees, and the temple bells they say, come you back, you British soldier, come you back to Mandalay. Come you back to Mandalay, where the old flotilla lay. Can you hear their paddles chunkin' from Rangoon to Mandalay? On the road to Mandalay, where the flying fishes play, and the dawn comes up like thunder out of China across the bay. Her petticoat was yellow and her little cap was green, and her name was Suppy Yorlat, just the same as Thibor's queen. And I seed her first a-smoking of a whacking white cheroot, and a-wasting Christian kisses on an heathen idol's foot. Blooming idol made of mud, what they call the great gourd bud. Plucky lot she cared for idols when I kissed her where she stood. On the road to Mandalay, where the flying fishes play, and the dawn comes up like thunder out of China across the bay. When the mist was on the rice fields and the sun was dropping slow, she'd get her little banjo and she'd sing Kulalo Lo. With her arm upon my shoulder and her cheek agin my cheek, we used to watch the steamers and the Hathis piling teak. Elephants are piling teak in the sludgy, squdgy creek, where the silence hung that heavy, you was half afraid to speak. On the road to Mandalay, where the flying fishes play, and the dawn comes up like thunder out of China, across the bay. But that's all shoved behind me long ago and far away, and there ain't no buses running from the bank to Mandalay. And I'm learning here in London what the 10-year soldier tells. If you've heard the East a-calling, you won't never heed naught else. No, you won't heed nothing else but them spicy garlic smelts and the sunshine and the palm trees and the tinkly temple bells. On the road to Mandalay, where the flying fishes play and the dawn comes up like thunder out of China across the bay. I am sick of wasting leather on these gritty paving stones, and the blasted English drizzle wakes the fever in my bones. Though I walks with 50 housemaids out at Chelsea to the Strand, and they talks a lot of loving, but what do they understand? Beefy face and grubby hand, Lord, what do they understand? I've a neater, sweeter maiden in a cleaner, greener land. On the road to Mandalay, where the flying fishes play, and the dawn comes up like thunder out of China across the bay. Ship me somewhere's east of Suez, where the best is like the worst, where there aren't no Ten Commandments and a man can raise a thirst. For the temple bells are calling, and it's there that I would be. By the old Mule Mine pagoda, looking lazy at the sea. On the road to Mandalay, where the old flotilla lay, with our sick beneath the awnings when we went to Mandalay. Oh, the road to Mandalay, where the flying fishes play, and the dawn comes up like thunder out of China across the bay. A poem from Me to You by Rudyard Kipling. Mandalay, a town liberated from an appalling occupation by the Japanese and restored to British rule by the 14th Army under the command of General Slim, and also a song they sang as they marched in 75 years ago. A great shame that Willard White lacks the imaginative capacity to grasp that at an event supposed to honour those men. 3 years later, Burma quit the empire. I mean, for real. Not like India, Pakistan, Ceylon, or Sir Willard's Jamaica, graduating to dominion status within the Commonwealth, brimming with post-war resentments against their imperial masters. Burma just checked out. 1 minute it was a crown colony under the King Emperor with Sir Herbert Rance as governor. Then the Union flag came down and it was a sovereign republic with Sao Shwe Thaik as president, the hereditary Saofa of Yang Wei. Shwe Thaik died in prison shortly after the 1962 coup, and his Saofarat was abolished, and Burma lost to the world. It was not, in objective terms, terribly important to the empire, but it loomed larger than almost anywhere else in the imperial imagination. To close, Oley Speaks, the American composer whose setting of Kipling's poem blew away a couple of dozen other settings of Mandalay. He's generally regarded as a one-hit wonder, but that's not strictly true. I heard a young lady sing this as her audition piece not that long ago. Written in 1910 and a million seller back then, music by Oley Speaks, words by Frank Lebby Stanton. He's the guy who wrote Mighty Like a Rose and Just a Wearyin' for You. Eileen Farrell sings Morning.
Mark Stein's Sunday Poems is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.